Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today, we're looking at a really interesting stack of materials, research, articles, notes, all focused on, well, a cornerstone of Kurdish culture, the dance traditions.
Yeah, and looking through this, one of the first hurdles, you could say, is just getting the terminology straight.
Yeah.
Especially how the word dabke gets used alongside specific Kurdish terms.
Right. So our goal here, exploring these sources, is really to pull out the key insights, understand that cultural richness that's packed into the movements, and hopefully give you a much clearer picture of what these dances mean to the Kurdish people.
Okay, so let's tackle that naming issue first. Dabke.
Huh.
When most people hear that, they think Levantine, right?
Yeah.
Lebanese, Jordanian, Palestinian, Syrian dances.
Exactly. And UNESCO even recognizes it as part of Palestinian cultural heritage. The word itself, it's Arabic, isn't it? Meaning something like stamping of the feet.
That's the one. Which, you know, describes a pretty common element in lots of line dances in the region. But crucially, the sources make it really clear that Kurdish communities have their own specific long-standing names for their traditional group dances.
Like Govend, Dilin, Helperke, Shai. Those are the terms that come up again and again in the Kurdish context.
And this is where it gets a bit muddy. Some sources seem to use dabke more broadly, like a regional umbrella term, because there are similarities in the line or circle form.
But others point out it can be an external label, maybe used by neighbors for Kurdish dances, potentially missing the distinct Kurdish background.
And that distinction really matters, doesn't it? Especially as the material highlights, for a stateless nation like the Kurds, where holding on to cultural identity is just vital.
Absolutely. These Kurdish traditions have their own histories, their own music, choreography, their own meanings baked in.
And there's a real sensitivity there about, well, cultural misattribution. The sources mention examples, like in Turkey, where some Kurdish dances have apparently been sort of rebranded as Turkish folk dances.
So that really underlines why, even if we see Kurdish dabke in some of the material we're looking at, we should probably prioritize the indigenous terms.
Exactly. Like Govend and Helperke, it respects that distinct cultural ownership and, honestly, lets us get into the specifics of the Kurdish forms themselves as they're described.
Makes sense. So let's dive into the heart of it. Kurdish dance, whether we call it Govend or Helperke, it's presented as just fundamental to Kurdish cultural expression, right up there with the music.
Definitely. And a key thing that jumps out is how communal it is.
Yeah.
These aren't really about solo performance. It's the group moving as one.
And something quite striking that's mentioned often is the mixed gender participation. You know, men and women dancing side by side in the same line or circle.
Which seems to reflect the significant role women often play in Kurdish society, right?
That's what the sources suggest. And the way they connect, holding hands, linking shoulders, it's not just practical, it's symbolic.
Symbolizing unity, cohesion. That physical link reinforces the social bond.
And then there's the leader. The Sershopi, or Sergovan,
yes.
Such an important figure.
Yeah, guiding the whole group, often with that handkerchief, the desmol, or sopi, using it to signal the steps, set the rhythm, maybe show off some more complex moves.
I saw a mention, too, of a specific arrangement sometimes called Jendamujo, wheat and barley.
Ah, yes, where men and women alternate in a line. Some interpret that as suggesting, well, egalitarian ideals kind of woven right into the dance structure.
It's almost like that the dance acts as a kind of social text. You can sort of read the social fabric, the gender dynamics, the community values right there in the movement.
There's even a striking example in the sources about a sports center in Iran reportedly being shut down specifically because of mixed gender Kurdish dances.
Wow. That really shows the cultural weight, the symbolic power these dances carry, and how they can sometimes be seen as challenging norms.
Absolutely. So understanding these basics helps us see it's not just steps, it's deeply woven into social life.
And this isn't something new. The history runs deep. The sources remind us Kurds are one of the ancient peoples of the Middle East.
Right, with a presence going back, 4,000 years, and a distinct Indo-European language group.
And what's really intriguing is how some sources connect this ancient history directly to the dances, particularly Helperke.
Yes, some Persian language sources explored here propose a link going all the way back to the Median Empire, around 678 BCE.
That's incredible, the idea that the Median king, Cyaxares, might have actually commanded these dances.
Especially after battles, yeah. Not just celebrating, but commemorating the wins, making sure the stories, the sagas weren't lost.
So the dance itself becomes a kind of living history lesson.
Potentially, yes. In that interpretation, specific movements get read symbolically. like Geryon, the slow start, maybe representing getting ready for battle.
And then the faster parts, a swift attack.
Possibly. And certain steps, like the three-step sepa, maybe symbolizing tactical moves, advances, retreats. It's a fascinating idea.
Is there any archaeological backing for this kind of antiquity?
Well, the sources do mention evidence. Stone carvings from the first millennium BCE showing instruments we still associate with Kurdish dance, like the Zurna and Dahol.
And figures moving rhythmically.
Exactly. And even older pottery, 4th or 5th millennia BCE, apparently showing group dances. So group dancing in the region is ancient.
Beyond the military links, there are other interpretations too, right? Connecting to nature, agriculture.
Yes. Ethnomusicologists like Dr. Koop Bensadeghi see helper keys foot stomping, possibly linked to old agrarian rituals, like stamping to wake up the earth, encourage fertility.
Makes sense. And the circle formation.
That's often interpreted as symbolizing cycles, time, seasons, the agricultural year. And sometimes upward hand gestures are seen as representing growth, or maybe a connection to the spiritual.
So pulling all that together, the dance isn't just movement. It's like a vessel carrying history, memory, worldview.
Exactly. A living archive. Mm. Especially important for a culture where maybe written histories have been suppressed or are harder to access. The dance itself helps people remember.
It really does make you stop and think how much history and belief can be encoded in just moving together.
And of course, it's not static. This isn't a museum piece. Kurdish dance has always evolved.
Adapting, changing over time, but still holding on to its core feeling, its essence.
And while you see similarities with neighbors, Assyrians, Armenians, Turks, Arabs, the sources stress that Kurdish dance keeps its distinct character. Especially that mixed gender aspect.
Though there is influence back and forth, surely.
Oh, absolutely. Cultural exchange is natural. In Rojava, for example, the material acknowledges influences from Arabic and Assyrian traditions. Some dances, like Bagi, might have originally been Assyrian, but were adopted and adapted by Kurds.
And what about modern influences? Globalization must be playing a role now.
It is. The sources touch on things like New Wave Dabke, which is more of a Levantine thing, fusing traditional rhythms with electronic music. Artists like Omar Suleiman, though he's Arab, his sound has had a regional impact.
And within the Kurdish community itself.
There's mention of Tekno Hale. You know, Kurdish youth taking traditional Governor Hale steps and dancing them to techno beats. It's a clear reinterpretation for a new generation.
Which must create a bit of tension, right, between this evolution and wanting to preserve the authentic forms.
Definitely. There are concerns about cultural dilution, maybe erasure, especially given the political context.
Because for a stateless nation, cultural preservation isn't just about folklore, is it? It's tied up with identity politics, resistance against assimilation.
Precisely. That Turkish example again. So the choices people make about how the dance evolves or is preserved, they carry real cultural and political weight.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Ladies here, Ruj Bosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect. Just what we needed.
Let's see. Ooh, smells wonderful today, Hannah. Thank you. How is it tasting?
Hmm. That's lovely and warm. Maybe. Is it just me, or is it a little bit sharp today?
You think so? Let me try.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe a touch. I might add a little sugar.
Me too, I think. Just a cube. There we go.
Okay, that hits the spot. Right then. Shall we get back to it?
Let's do it.
Okay, so back from our chai. We were talking about evolution and preservation, but maybe we should drill down into the actual building blocks of the dance itself.
Good idea. We mentioned the formation circle, semicircle, line. But the way dancers connect is really key, isn't it?
Holding hands, linking shoulders. What was that specific hold called?
The Kurdish hand hold, sometimes interlacing pinky fingers. Or hands might go on neighbors' backs or shoulders.
And the sources stress, again, this isn't just functional, it's reinforcing that community feeling.
Absolutely. That social meaning is embedded in the touch. And the leader, the sershupi, is so crucial here.
With the handkerchief, the desmal.
Exactly. At the head of the line, using it to signal, guide the energy, lead the changes, maybe show off a bit. And the person at the other end, the benshopi, helps keep the lines drawn.
Okay, what about the steps themselves, the core movement?
Well, stomping is fundamental, striking the ground. It's right there in the name, dabki, and possibly helper key too, that sense of jumping or stamping.
Connecting dancers to the earth, providing that rhythm.
Right. And while Levantine dabki often has that standard six-count rhythm, Kurdish dance steps are incredibly varied. It really depends on the region, the specific dance.
And we mentioned men and women dancing together, but are there typical differences in how they move?
Generally speaking, yes. The sources often describe men's movements as potentially faster, more athletic, maybe more complex footwork.
While women's movements might emphasize more subtle, graceful things, shoulders, knees, neck.
That's often the description, yeah. Though in mixed groups, they're often doing the same or complementary steps.
Which leads us nicely into regional styles, because it's not all the same across Kurdistan, is it?
Not at all. Big differences.
Yeah.
Particularly between the Kurmanji-speaking areas north and west and the Sarani-speaking areas south and east.
So, Kurmanji styles, what are the characteristics mentioned?
Often described as having a more upright posture, tighter holds like that picky finger hold, and movements that are sharp, energetic, maybe more visually striking.
Okay, and contrast that with the Sarani styles.
There, the sources often mention simpler footwork, but a real focus on continuous, fluid shoulder movements, like raising and dropping the shoulders, a kind of swaying, lilting body motion, sometimes described as almost fish-like.
Interesting. And these dance styles mirror the linguistic and other cultural variations across the region.
Exactly. And the music is completely intertwined with this, obviously, providing that essential pulse, the structure, usually strong downbeats.
Common rhythms mentioned are things like 24 for driving energy and maybe 68 for something more flowing.
That sounds right. And there's often that dynamic buildup, starting slower, letting everyone sync up, then gradually accelerating to build excitement.
And specific tunes go with specific dances, like Garian or Shimame.
Yes. And the lyrics of those folk songs often carry stories, emotions, add another layer of meaning.
Now, instruments. If you had to pick the iconic sound of Kurdish dance music.
It has to be the zurna and the dahul. No question.
The zurna, that's the loud, almost piercing wind instrument. Oboe-like.
Exactly. And the dahul is the big double-headed drum, usually slung over the shoulder, played with different kinds of beaters.
And that pair, zurna and dahul, their sound just cuts through, perfect for big outdoor gatherings, festivals, new rows.
Absolutely. It's powerful, festive, driving. It's become a potent sonic symbol of Kurdish cultural identity, of assertion even.
But they're not the only instruments used, right? The sources mention others.
Oh, yeah, depending on the context. The region, you might hear oud, mijwis, tabla, the long-necked tambour, Comanche, knee flute, a whole range reflecting the breadth of Kurdish musical traditions.
So that variety in sound matches the variety in the dances themselves.
Precisely. Which brings us back to that regional diversity. The material really underscores that Kurdish dance isn't monolithic. It's this amazing constellation of styles that vary across Kurdistan, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria, sometimes even from village to village.
And the main dividing line seems to follow those dialect groups we mentioned, Kurmanji versus Sarani.
Largely, yes. And the sources list so many named dances under these umbrellas. For Kurmanji, things like Kichiko, Çapikli, Garzan. For Sarani, Girdun, Çepi, Kanimiri, just to name a few.
Maybe we could highlight one or two specific examples from the material just to give a flavor of the differences.
Sure. Let's take Sheikhani. Found in Bedinan, also shared with Assyrians and Kurdish Jews, often uses that Kurdish hold. The movement is described as erect, strong, sharp, with a bounce, a two-step pattern, some kicks.
And interestingly, the sources note that sometimes the detailed descriptions rely on Assyrian documentation.
Right, which highlights both the cultural sharing in the region and sometimes the challenges in finding purely Kurdish-focused documentation for every single variation. It's often linked to the song Shimame.
Okay, what about a Sarani example? Jiran seems prominent, especially from Sanandaj in Iran.
Very famous, yes. Described as a joyful dance for happy occasions, known for distinctive melodies and loads of variations. One group apparently performs eight types.
And that's the one whose name, Garian, the slow part, gets linked back to that Median war dance theory.
That's the connection some sources make. Then there's Çepi, widespread Sarani dance. Simpler core step, two forward, two back, but allowing for lots of expressive body movement. Also called a joyful dance.
We see regional styles reflected in the holds, the steps, the overall feeling.
Exactly. And there's so many others mentioned. Kesiko from Turkey, described with complex leader called steps. Girdun, listed as Sarani, but harder to find specific choreographic details for. Hayriman styles, noted as tough dances with unique attire. Du Dasmale from Kermanshah, using two handkerchiefs. It's incredibly rich.
And documenting all this diversity must be a huge challenge, especially with so much being passed down orally.
A major challenge, which makes the research and preservation efforts we'll touch on later so vital.
Okay, before we get to preservation, there's another huge element. The visual aspect, the traditional clothing.
Oh, absolutely crucial. It's not just costume. The sources describe it as deeply reflecting history, region, identity, skill. and it actively enhances the dance.
You see these incredibly vibrant colors, complex patterns, lots of layering.
And so much diversity depending on the region or tribe. Often handmade, with detailed embroidery, beadwork, sequins.
Wearing it, especially for big events like New Rose or weddings, it's clearly a powerful statement.
A statement of identity, of pride, a visual confirmation of being Kurdish, but also showcasing the diversity within that identity.
Let's break it down a bit. Men's attire, designed for movement, right?
Generally, yes. Loose trousers, the shalwar, often tapered to make footwork easier. A shirt, maybe a jacket or a vest like the felt farangi or wool pastak.
And that distinctive waistband, the peshtwin.
Or shal, can be incredibly long, wrapped multiple times. Different regions have different styles, and some sources even suggest the knots can symbolize Zoroastrian principles.
Plus headwear, turbans, caps, scarves like the jamana, and specific shoes.
The clash or giva. Often handmade, woven with flat soles, really good for dancing. Sometimes wool leg warmers too, puzawana.
Okay, and women's attire. The sources describe it as just stunning.
Vibrant, elaborate, ornate. Usually centered around a long, flowing dress, the cross or jili kurdi, often covered in sequins, embroidery, beadwork.
And that really unique feature, the long, dangling sleeves.
The fakiana or senbusi. Triangular, flowing sleeves that move with the dance, almost like extra handkerchiefs. Very expressive.
And layering, too. Vests, jackets.
Yes, ornate vests or jackets. Kalonji, often worn over the dress. Sometimes velvet, adorned with coins. Undergarments, too. Zirakras and dark or shalwar. Plus intricate headwear, caps or scarves, maybe small turbans, often decorated.
And jewelry seems key as well.
Abundant jewelry. Necklaces, amber, coins, bracelets, earrings, rings, sometimes ankle bracelets. Coin belts are common too, adding sound and sparkle. Shawls as well.
So it's a whole coordinated look, loaded with meaning.
Exactly. The attire is like a visual language. It tells you about region, maybe status, history, beliefs. Materials and styles are adapted to local environments. Colors have significance.
And specific elements, like those shell knots or the senbusi sleeves adding to the movement. Even the leader's handkerchief, the shopi or dasmal, can symbolize different things depending on color and context. A flag, peace, uprising.
It's a powerful performance of identity. Just putting on the clothes, complementing the dance perfectly. A visual testament to Kurdish unity and diversity.
It really makes you appreciate how clothing everywhere carries layers of meaning, but it seems especially potent here.
So, bringing it all together, Why does Kurdish dance matter so much? The sources are emphatic. This isn't just entertainment, it's fundamental.
Right, woven into the fabric of social life. Essential at weddings, festivals, birthdays, any big community gathering.
It's the main way people share joy, express solidarity. And its inclusive nature, bringing people together, physically strengthens those community bonds.
Especially at New Rose, March 21st. That seems paramount.
Absolutely. New Rose is a huge symbol of identity, freedom, renewal. Linked to the cow with the blacksmith legend, dancing around the bonfires, wearing the traditional clothes. It's a core ritual.
And this is where the political dimension really comes to the fore, as the material highlights.
Yes, especially where Kurdish culture has been suppressed. Dancing at Newroz becomes a powerful political act, a symbol of resilience, of reclaiming heritage, asserting identity and rights. That collective energy embodies hope, aspirations for freedom.
So the sources really position the dance as this incredibly potent symbol, first, of Kurdish identity and unity.
Crucial for a stateless people. That shared practice, the linked hands, the synchrony in body solidarity, nationhood. Helperki specifically is described as a symbol of unity and order.
Second, as a symbol of cultural resilience and resistance.
Right. Performing these dances publicly, especially if they've been restricted, is a political statement. It defies assimilation, asserts we are still here, our culture lives. Aesthetics and resistance become linked.
And third, it's about communal joy and storytelling.
Expressing shared emotions, yes. And maybe even carrying narratives. That possible link of Gavenden to Garnuvenden, to say and to move, suggests stories, histories, myths conveyed through movement and sound.
Plus the song lyrics adding to that narrative layer. It's like a living library of memories, values, oral traditions.
And that fosters cohesion, connects generations. It all underlines just how vital this practice is in shaping Kurdish society and identity.
So what's the state of Kurdish dance today? It's clearly alive and well, but evolving too.
Definitely. Traditional forms are still vibrant at community events, but you also see those adaptations we mentioned, like Tenno Halei, among younger people.
And dance is being adapted for the stage, formal troops performing.
Yes, which helps raise awareness internationally, but it does shift the context away from that original social participatory setting.
And the diaspora communities, they must play a huge role.
Absolutely critical, especially in Europe, North America. For Kurds living outside the homeland, dance becomes this incredibly important connection to heritage, to community.
A way to keep memories alive, affirm identity, create a sense of belonging.
Exactly. You see self-organized troops, cultural festivals. The sources mention Paris as an example. Sometimes displacement actually intensifies these practices. Dance becomes a very conscious act of affirmation. They're active agents in keeping it going, reinterpreting it, passing it on.
Which brings us to preservation efforts more broadly. What's being done to document and support these traditions?
Several things. Dedicated festivals, both within Kurdistan, like the Duhok Kurdish Dance Festival, bringing different regions together, and in the diaspora.
Institutions are involved too.
Yes, significantly. The Kurdish Heritage Institute, KHI, in Sulaymaniyah, is mentioned as a key player, collecting, archiving, preserving music, folklore, clothing, dance documentation. Digitization efforts are crucial there. Other Kurdish institutes, like in Paris or Lausanne, also contribute.
And academic work, archives.
There are studies, like Aslan Adari's book, mentioned in the sources. Archives like the Kurdish Digital Archive or the Mizrahi Dance Archive are trying to document these traditions, recognizing the challenge of capturing something so rooted in oral transmission.
Plus, online platforms now offer new ways to learn and share.
Right. So the sources seem to suggest its future vitality depends on this mix. The ongoing grassroots community practice, people actually dancing it, combined with these more formal efforts of documentation, archiving, scholarship.
A symbiotic relationship, especially important when state support might be lacking or even hostile.
Exactly. These combined efforts are what help ensure the tradition thrives for the next generation.
So, as we wrap up this exploration, we've really covered a lot of ground, from sorting out the names like Govind and Helperki and tracing those possible ancient origins.
To breaking down the movements, the music, the absolutely stunning attire, exploring all those regional variations.
And finally, understanding its profound social and symbolic meaning as a testament to identity, unity, resilience, and just sheer communal joy.
And it's clear this isn't just history. It's a living, breathing, evolving tradition, kept alive by communities both at home and spread across the globe, supported by dedicated preservation work.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you, drawing from everything we've discussed based on these sources.
Just consider how something that might seem simple, a group of people dancing together, can carry such an incredible weight of history, how it can function as a language of identity, even resistance.
And how it connects people across time, across borders, especially for a nation navigating such complex political realities, it makes you wonder what other cultural practices anywhere in the world might be doing that same vital work.
Something to ponder.
Thank you for listening to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.